Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dr. James Brooks, Melanie Trent, the Shutter Library Director here at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this special edition of our Scholar series, because of course it is Women's History Month. I just want to make sure everyone can hear me at the back okay. Perfect, absolutely. So we wish to acknowledge the generosity of former trustee Anne Worrell, who endowed this lecture series in honor of our former president and CEO, Dr. Charles Bryan. Today's lecture is in partnership with the Edith Bowling Wilson Birthplace Museum. Located in Whitfield, Virginia, the museum operates in Edith's historic family home. We've been working today in the past few weeks with the museum's executive director, Stephen De Niro, along with his wife, Dolores, and also with Farron Smith, who founded the museum in 2005. I'm unsure whether they're joining us today, but if they are, hello there, Stephen and Dolores. It's so nice to see you. All of these individuals and everyone employed by the museum work to raise awareness and increase community appreciation of the birthplace and childhood home of Edith Bowling Wilson. And we, of course, extend a warm welcome to them today. So thank you for being in attendance. Just before we begin with today's program, I just want to run through a couple of notices about upcoming events here at the museum. So as many of you will know, March 16th, we'll see the opening of our newest traveling exhibition, Julia Child, A Recipe for Life. This special exhibition explores the key ingredients that led to Julia's personal evolution, as well as a culinary revolution across the United States, whilst also making relevant connections to Virginia foodways. For those of you who are members, I believe there are still places available on our March 14th members preview, which will take place at 5 p.m. So that'll offer you a chance to have a sneak peek at that wonderful exhibition that has been made all the more special by the work of our curator, Paige Newman. And on Thursday, March 21st, please join us for our next noontime lecture here in the Robbins Forum to continue our Women's History Month programming, as we host Cynthia A. Kernier for a discussion of her new book, The Tory's Wife, A Woman and Her Family in Revolutionary America. So before we turn to today's program, I just want to ask you all to take a quick moment to make sure that your mobile phones are set to either do not disturb or silent, just to ensure that we'll have no interruptions with what promises to be a wonderful lecture today. While the United States is yet to elect its first female president, and though history has downplayed her role, just over a century ago, a woman became the nation's first acting president. She was born in 1872, and her name was Edith Bowling Galt Wilson. Edith climbed her way out of Appalachian poverty and into the highest echelons of American power, and in 1919, effectively acted as the first female president of the United States when her husband, Woodrow Wilson, was temporarily incapacitated. Edith was a complicated figure whose personal quest for influence reshaped the position of First Lady into one of political prominence forever. Rebecca Boggs Roberts joins us today to offer an unflinching look at the woman whose ascent mirrors that of many powerful American women before and since. Rebecca is an award-winning educator, author, and speaker, and a leading historian of American women's suffrage and civic participation. She currently serves as the Deputy Director of Events at the Library of Congress and serves on the board of the National Archives Foundation, as well as on the Council of Advisors of the Women's Suffrage National Monument Foundation. Her books include the award-winning The Suffragist Playbook, Your Guide to Changing the World, Suffragettes in Washington, D.C., The 1913 Parade and the Fight for the Vote, and most recently, Untold Power, The Fascinating Rise and Complex Legacy of First Lady Edith Wilson, which will form the basis of today's talk. So please join me in welcoming Rebecca Boggs Roberts.
Good afternoon. Thank you all so much for being here. I'm delighted to spend an afternoon in Richmond. I came down from Washington this morning. I left early because you know that stretch of 95 is always terrible. And I was really pleased with myself for cutting out the traffic before I realized that I had not actually brought along any reading glasses. So before I came here, I did a quick stop to CVS. So sorry for the tacky readers, but that was the only way I would be able to get through this lecture. As was mentioned, I have done a lot of work on the suffrage movement, and I first got interested in Edith Wilson's story because when I was giving a lot of talks leading up to the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, I kept getting asked about Edith. People would say, did Woodrow Wilson finally change his mind on the 19th Amendment because she told him to? Which is 100% not the case. She was actually anti-suffrage, but that narrative was out there in the world somewhere. And so I started reading up on her because the questions were so inevitable that I wanted to make sure I was answering them as fully as possible. And I realized two things. One, she and her life were absolutely fascinating. And two, that most biographies which saw her through the lens of Woodrow Wilson had reduced her to a stock character because they only focused on that moment in 1919 when she took the reins of executive power. And I get why, right? I mean, it's a fascinating chapter in American history. But if you only take a snapshot of her life, anyone's life, you're just not going to get a full picture of who she was. And so biographers reduced her either to a sort of naive rube who was taken advantage of by, you know, politically savvy men, not the case. A Machiavellian, you know, Lady Macbeth type who seized power for her own agenda. There's a little truth in that, but mainly not the case. Or sort of the best Mrs. Woodrow Wilson she could be, this devoted wife who was standing by her man and put the needs of her husband before the needs of the country, and maybe was a little naive, but her heart was in the right place. That's a little bit more of the case, but again, no one's a stock character. No two-dimensional representation can describe someone. And the trickiest part about Edith is that that third characterization, that perfect, dutiful wife, she was the biggest proponent of it. She was the one curating that image. She wrote a memoir in 1939, totally worth reading. It is frank. It's funny. It is also in places provably untrue. And so you have to take her as an unreliable narrator of her own story. But also she spends that whole memoir downplaying her own role in history. Like, who does that? Who writes a whole book to say they did less than people are giving them credit for? No man ever, I'll tell you that. So I set out to try to create a three-dimensional picture of Edith Bowling Galt Wilson. And in places, she was the only source, right? So no one was paying any attention to her before she married the president in 1915. And so, for instance, her childhood in Wytheville, her memoir is the only first person, you know, primary source for that. And because she's unreliable, there were times where, and I'm happy to answer more questions about sort of sourcing and how I verified stories, but
I couldn't verify a lot of things she said in her memoir. What I could verify was what Reconstruction era Southwest Virginia was like, right? Same thing when she moved to Washington as a teenager. I knew what Gilded Age Washington was like. So I was able to provide sort of context of her time and place in places where the only source for her actual life was her. So let's talk about her life. I love this picture. She's three in this picture. She looks so grouchy, doesn't she? I suspect one of the reasons she's grouchy is because she's wearing pants. It's the only picture I've ever seen of Edith where she's not beautifully turned out. And it is possible the pants are the result of hand-me-downs. She was the sixth of nine kids. And she, as was mentioned, grew up in Wytheville, Virginia. So this is the house, the birthplace that is now preserved as a museum. And I took this picture myself from the roof of the hotel across the way, which Farron and Bill Smith also own. But that building all the way on my left, on your right, is not part of it. So those first three storefronts, you can see, I really like this picture because you can see, first of all, it's right there on Main Street. The first floor of all of those doorways is a storefront. Now it's Skeeter's Hot Dogs and a coffee shop, and then the Edith Bowling Wilson Birthplace Museum. The second floor is where the family lived. And then the third floor is a false gable. So they were all crammed in there. Remember I said nine kids, both parents, both grandmothers, aunt, cousin, various law students, hangers-on, house guests, whoever stayed there, welcome. They were all in there on that second level. And it's a funny little rabbit warren of rooms. They don't all connect to each other. Sometimes you have to go downstairs, go upstairs. And the other thing that I think is so striking about this picture is the mountains are right there, right? She's still our only Appalachian First Lady. So worth a visit if you haven't been to Wytheville. The second floor of the family home is tourable, but not preserved. And they could really use your support to be able to bring that back to life. So she grew up, born in 1872, Reconstruction era. She easily could have gotten lost in the shuffle of that very crowded house. Her family had been planters in the James River Valley, enslavers, tobacco planters. And after the Civil War, when that economic system collapsed, and they sort of came down in the world economically, they moved to this property that was Mr. Bowling had as an investment property. And so she was very much brought up on those lost cause myths, right? That this was not the childhood she deserved, that there had been a grand antebellum world that is what she should have been born into. She was directly descended from Pocahontas. The Bowlings took that very, very seriously. She delineates every generation of descent from Pocahontas in her memoir. So that whole First Families of Virginia, which I don't need to explain to this audience, they're Yankees. I have to tell them what that is. That was very much the legacy she was given. But the family was straitened economically, and there were a whole lot of them. And so you could see where Edith could have been sort of anonymous in that house. And the reason she wasn't, according to her, is because of this grandmother. This was her father's mother, Grandmother Bowling. Terrifying, right? Grandmother Bowling was, she had been paralyzed in a, she'd been thrown from a horse as a young woman. And so she sort of held court from this rocking chair throne in the middle of the house. She continued to wear the Civil War era hoop skirts. She had, you know, a mourning brooch of human hair. That item on the back of her rocking chair is the tanned skin of a dead dog. It's just so gothic and creepy. But she looked at that raft of grandchildren and, for reasons known only to her, singled out Edith and said, you are special. You are smart. You are capable. You can do great things. And that was not a message a lot of girls were getting in Southwest Virginia in the 1870s. And it wasn't even the message Edith was getting from her other grandmother, who also lived with them, and her mother. So her maternal grandmother and her mother were very much part of that Victorian era cult of true womanhood. Women should be pious and submissive and domestic. And yet Grandmother Bowling was there saying, and smart and capable and ambitious. And I don't think it's entirely fair to
psychoanalyze someone 150 years after their birth, but I think those competing lessons explain a lot about Edith. She was, by nature, much more bent to what Grandmother Bowling was telling her, but she felt she had to pretend it wasn't true, that she had to dress it up in sort of feminine, it's actually a man's idea, I'm doing it all for a man. And so throughout her life, you see her accomplish pretty impressive things and pretend she isn't. So she, isn't she lovely? This is teenage Edith. Look at that waist, right? Can you only imagine the corsetry going on underneath that dress? So she went to school for a year in Abingdon, hated it, came home, went to school for another year here in Richmond, loved it. But the headmaster, it was called Powell School, and the headmaster was almost killed by the new streetcar system that was installed here in the 1880s. And all the girls were sent home from school. And when she went back to Withville, she was now 17, 18, and there were some conversations about, does she go back to school? But by the time the next school year rolled around, children 7, 8, and 9 in the Bowling family were all boys. And they had to use the money they had to educate the boys. So Edith was done with school and really didn't want to stick around Withville and marry another, you know, first family is a Virginia boy and never leave. So she went to Washington. Her older sister Gertrude had married a man named Alexander Galt, and they lived in Washington, and they had a baby. And the excuse was Edith could come help with the baby. And so this is 1890. 1890s Washington was just booming. I mean, it's really hard to describe what an explosion of wealth and infrastructure and culture was going on at the time in the city. The post-Civil War boom, the Boss-Shepard public works initiatives, but also all of that sort of parvenu Gilded Age money was coming in. If you think about, you know, Mark Twain, who coined the term the Gilded Age, Edith Wharton, who wrote about it, they have characters in their books who moved to Washington because it was easier to break into society there than in, you know, Mrs. Astor's New York. And so I don't know how well all of you know Washington, but like that row up Massachusetts Avenue where the Cosmos Club and Anderson House and the Indonesian Embassy, all those are all mansions built in that era. Edith didn't have any money, but she did enjoy the sort of booming cultural moment that was going on there. She went to the theater all the time. She heard a ton of live music, and she sort of became the sophisticated, attractive, young urban woman she imagined she could be. Her memoir, you know, she talks all about the horse-drawn streetcars and the sopranos she got to hear, and she just gushes over this time in her life. And then sort of parenthetically, she says, oh yeah, and then I married Norman. Poor Norman. Norman, by all accounts, was a perfectly nice guy, maybe a little dull. He was significantly older than Edith. He was her sister's husband's cousin, Norman Galt. And he ran Galt. I don't know how many of you remember Galt and Brothers Jewelers in Washington. It was sort of our local Tiffany's. This is the storefront. Silver and jewelry from Galt's was the thing, you know, that's where everyone got their engagement rings and their christening cups and everything else, and had since 1800. You know, Thomas Jefferson bought a coffee service there. And Norman, so as the owner of this long-standing, high-end, successful business, was very well respected. And he was an upright citizen. You know, he was on his church vestry and he was on the Chamber of Commerce and he gave to all the right causes. And if he was sort of fussy and maybe not particularly exciting, he was a sincere, lovely guy who was really smitten with Edith, and he was stable and he was secure, and she married him, mainly, as far as I can tell, to stay in Washington. They had one baby who didn't survive. They lived in this house. It doesn't survive, sadly. This is a duplex. They lived in the side on my right. This is on 20th Street between N and O in DuPont Circle in Washington, fashionable address. This wasn't a particularly big house. It was very narrow, but it was very, again, urban sophisticate. And
Norman died in 1908. That gets not even a full sentence in Edith's memoir. It gets like a dependent clause. And she inherited Galt's. So think about how unusual that was in 1908, right? Married women's property laws had only been passed at the end of the 19th century. Virginia was last, by the way. So this notion of women owning their own property, women as an executor of a man's will, women being able to sign contracts and control their own wealth was unusual. And had they had children, had Norman's father been alive, had his brother not been an invalid, had there been some man who could have contested it, it would have been different. But instead, Edith got to be this independent widow of means. She had money. She had access to it. She didn't need a chaperone because she was a widow. She lived in DuPont Circle, and she was really good at it, at being that person. She became the first woman in Washington to get a driver's license. And she became known for driving her little electric car around town. Let me tell you, this is a research rabbit hole. I fell so deeply down. The history of electric cars. So this is Edith in her electric car. I don't know how well you can tell, but it's sort of steered by this kind of tiller from the seat. It's kind of a buggy-shaped golf cart. And because these electric cars, top speed, 13 miles an hour, because they didn't make a lot of noise and you didn't have to crank them and they weren't dirty the way early gas cars were, they were appealing to women. And so urban women who didn't need to go much faster than 13 miles an hour, that was already faster than a horse and could sort of tool around town in them, really enjoyed these cars. And the car manufacturers figured that out. And so they started marketing them to women. So they had a bud vase on the dash. Edith usually had an orchid in hers. Edith was devoted to orchids. In fact, when she finally met Woodrow Wilson, he wrote to her, "You are the only woman I know who can wear an orchid. On everyone else, the orchid wears the woman." Edith was 5'9". She was almost my height, and she was not afraid to wear a like dinner plate sized orchid corsage. So she could pull off these sort of, you know, orchids you could see from space. But she was known in Washington for zipping around town in her little electric car. And if you read other memoirs of the time, like Alice Roosevelt Longworth and Ellen Morey Sladen and other sort of gossipy memoirs, they all mention seeing Mrs. Galt in her little electric car. So that's who captured Woodrow Wilson, this sophisticated, wealthy, independent widow. How did she meet Woodrow Wilson? Well, this is also a picture from that era. This picture is the cover of my book, and I kind of insisted on it. There's a picture I'll show you later where Edith is kind of leaning over Woodrow's shoulder. That's the cover of a lot of books about them because of the symbolism of her looking over his shoulder. I get it. But I wanted to feature just her, but also that like shoulders back facing the world, you know? This is, of course, a black and white picture, and my publisher colorized it sort of Tiffany blue, which I love. There's no reason to believe this dress was blue, but I do love this picture. So meanwhile, over in New Jersey, Wilson was the president of Princeton University. These are his daughters and his first wife. So starting from this end, middle daughter, Jessie, first wife, Ellen, youngest daughter, Nell, Margaret, Ellen, Nell, Jessie, Woodrow. So just quickly about the timing, he was president of Princeton. He ran for New Jersey governor in 1910, took office in 1911, ran for president in 1912, took office in 1913. So he had been in public office a minute and a half when he became president. And if you remember, the 1912 election was that year that William Howard Taft was running for re-election. Teddy Roosevelt decided to challenge him on the Bull Moose Party third party ticket. So they split the Republican vote and really kind of would have elected any old Democrat. But Wilson had won the primary. I'll give him credit for that. It's still the election where the third party candidate has garnered the most votes in American history. So Wilson comes to Washington in March of 1913 for his inauguration. All three daughters are unmarried at the time. His wife, Ellen, is first lady. It was not her natural habitat. Ellen was an educated, accomplished woman. She was a painter of some renown, but the Washington press thought her dowdy and badly dressed, and she didn't like that ceremonial social side of being First Lady. She was a little awkward. It never came easily to her. The daughters liked it better. They were all in their 20s, but one by one, they started to get married. So Jessie, the middle daughter, got married in early 1914. Her husband was a professor at Williams College at the time, so they moved up to Massachusetts. Nell, the youngest daughter, married her father's Secretary of the Treasury, who had children older than she was. It was all scandalous. So she and William McAdoo stayed in Washington but moved out of the White House. Margaret, the oldest daughter, never married, but she was trying to build a career as a soprano. So she was touring, singing. And in August of 1914, Ellen died of what was then called Bright's disease. It's a kidney ailment. And they had been married over 30 years. I mean, by all accounts, Wilson was absolutely heartbroken when Ellen died. And he was kind of rattling around the White House alone. Two daughters were gone. One was off on tour. And his doctor, Carrie Grayson, was worried about him. And Carrie Grayson was a friend of Edith's. And so Grayson went to Edith and said, I'm worried about the president. He's lonesome. And he's got this cousin. So that's Grayson in the middle and Nell McAdoo on my left. This woman here is Helen Bones, who was Wilson's cousin. She was brought to the White House to be Ellen's social secretary. And she was sort of stuck holding the First Lady bag, right? Everyone else had gone. So there is cousin Helen with no one to talk to and, you know, a depressed president. And so Carrie Grayson says to Edith, go be nice to Helen, go make friends. And Edith said, no, I don't want any part of Federal Washington. That's not my scene. And Grayson said, you don't need to be part of Federal Washington. They're not doing anything official. They're in mourning. She just needs a friend. Go be a friend. So Edith acquiesced, and she and Helen did become friends. And what they would mainly do together is go for walks through Rock Creek Park. And then they would go have tea at Edith's townhouse in Dumont Circle. And one day Helen said, come back to the White House for tea. And Edith said, we've just been in the mud. I look terrible. I don't want to go to the White House. And Helen said, no, I insist. You know, I'm always the guest. You never let me host. Come, we'll take the elevator straight to the private quarters. No one will see your muddy boots. It'll be fine. So Edith goes to the White House. It's a total setup. She goes up in the elevator. The doors open. There's the president and Carrie Grayson right off the golf course. They both were apparently terrible at golf. And the president is gobsmacked, smitten from that moment. How do we know he was smitten from that moment? Well, their love letters exist. They're at the Library of Congress. And how to put this? So as a scholar of suffrage, I have never been Woodrow Wilson's biggest fan. He cultivated this image of intellectual superiority, of moral righteousness, almost to the point of priggishness. Let me tell you, those man's letters, they are steamy. You almost get embarrassed 100 years. You do, 100 years later, reading through them, you get a little cringy. So from the very beginning, from the moment they met, he is writing these ardent, gushing letters. You are the perfect female form, and I want to kiss your eyelids. And right. And what was amazing to me is she's writing back. That's nice. Can we talk about William Jennings Bryan? Do you think he's going to resign as Secretary of State? Who do you think is going to take his place? Maybe you should appoint me. What? What? And so these letters throughout the spring and summer of 1915, they stay this way. He'll say, you know, oh, when you were having tea with Helen the other day, I snuck into the green room of the White House and I spied on you through the lace curtains. And weren't you clever to sit where I could see you? He's the president of the United States during war. And he's, you know, and she writes back, that's nice. You know, your last letter to the Germans about sinking the Lusitania was not your best work. So he's just putting it all out there and she's writing back about politics. And she maintained publicly that she was never political. It's garbage. She was absolutely political, and she was from the very beginning desperately interested in his work. And he finally figured that out. He didn't stop with the kiss your eyelid stuff, but as he sent her these gushy letters, he accompanied them with these huge packets of like pending legislation and statements he was working on and diplomatic correspondence. He'd just courier it on over to 20th Street. He taught her his cipher so she could decode his letters from diplomats. You know, security issues be damned. I want my girlfriend to know what's going on. So throughout the summer of 1915, she starts learning more and more about his work, and he starts relying on her more and more as a confidant. He was never someone who had a great big cabinet of advisors. That was not the way he operated. His very closest advisors, Joe Tumulty, his chief of staff, Carrie Grayson, his doctor, Colonel House, Edward House. Edith started kind of undermining Tumulty and House. She succeeded in undermining House. Tumulty sort of stuck around. She was always an ally of Grayson since they had been friends before. So he kept proposing. She kept turning him down. Finally, she told him she'd marry him if he lost re-election. that she was okay with marrying him, but she didn't want to be first lady. He convinced her otherwise. They got married at the end of 1915. This is the sweetheart picture that was published in the newspapers. They married in her house, not in the White House. And then 1916 was an election year. So Edith turned out to be a pretty good campaigner. She never gave speeches of her own, and she never championed a cause the way other first ladies had. But she shook every hand, and she made the host feel important, and she was unfailingly well-mannered and gracious, and she smoothed the way for Wilson. Wilson was a little shy, and she was certainly not. I mean, if you think about every stage, right, getting out of Whitfield and going to Washington, owning a small business, becoming, you know, the first licensed driver, like, Edith just figured it out, whether she had been trained to do it or not. She just counted on her own confidence and ability to get her through. And that served her very well as first lady. By 1917, and Wilson gets reelected in 16, barely. By 1917, the US is now involved in World War I. Being a wartime first lady is a whole other ball of wax. And Edith was quite good at that too. She really mastered the collective responsibility part of being a role model in war. She did all the Meatless Mondays and Wheatless Wednesdays. She volunteered at the Red Cross. She had sheep grazing the White House lawn to save the gardening staff to be able to do war work. And then when the sheep, first of all, produced more sheep, but also got quite woolly, she auctioned off the wool to benefit the Red Cross. You know, she was good at that kind of stuff. And then the war ends at the end of 1918, and the peace negotiations begin in Paris. Wilson insisted on going in person. That was controversial at the time. No president had really left the country for any extended period of time. I think Teddy Roosevelt had gone to, you know, observe the Panama Canal for like an afternoon, and that was about it. No first lady had left the country while first lady at all ever. And they were going to be gone for months. And there were people who felt that Wilson was sort of giving up his moral high ground to go get his hands dirty, negotiating the treaty himself. But he was always going to go. I mean, that was his whole point, right? The whole reason that he justified U.S. action in World War I, considering we had no territory at stake, was to have a voice in the peace, to be able to help shape the post-war world, and particularly Wilson's notion of the League of Nations, that there would be a cooperative security agreement ensuring that there wouldn't be a war of that scale again. And in order to fight for his beloved League of Nations, personally, he was always going to go to Paris himself. And where he went, she went. So off they went. And I can't downplay, I mean, there's no way to overplay the scope of the ceremonial events and the what a big deal those months in Paris were. First of all, you know, they're staying at Buckingham Palace when they go visit the King and Queen of England. They're feted everywhere they go. You know, Edith is giving keys to various cities. This is a parade in Paris where the flowers thrown at them got so thick they were a little worried that suffocated in their buggy and had to sort of shove some of them out of the car as it went by. It's it was just an enormous deal. Wilson was hailed as a hero and she was right there with him. And so you see the pictures from this era where she's standing in all of these momentous moments and no first lady had done that before. You know, now we think of this kind of international diplomacy role as very much part of the First Lady's portfolio, but no one had done it before. They get back to Washington. This is now June of 1919. So they're gone from November of 1918 to June of 1919. They came back once briefly to close the last Congress, open the next one. So think about that, being gone that long in an era before, you know, mass communication. The 1918 midterms, the Democrats had lost both the House and Senate. So there are plenty of senators who have to, you know, Senate's job to ratify treaties. And there are plenty who are just not going to give Wilson this win, right? Just for partisan reasons. Then there's a whole subset of senators who are willing to compromise on the treaty, but they are particularly critical of the League of Nations because they worry that this collective security agreement will take the declaration of war power away from the Senate and make it an automatic thing. And so they want to make sure that their right to declare war is constitutionally preserved. Wilson won't compromise on the treaty at all. He wants an up or down vote, no negotiation, no compromise. So they're at a stalemate throughout the summer of 1919. And Wilson, meanwhile, he was never the strongest specimen in the world. He was never the healthiest guy around. And he had gotten quite sick in Paris. It was 1918. He got the flu. It might not have been the Spanish flu, but he got quite sick. And then he was exhausted and overworked. And he comes back to this, you know, bare knuckle fight with the Senate. So he's just absolutely dragging through the summer of 1919. And he decides what he really needs to do is take a massive cross-country train tour. That, right? You all know that's a terrible idea. You can see it coming. But he thought if he took the cause to the American people and convinced them of the righteousness of the League of Nations, they would pressure their senators and it would all work. And again, he couldn't get on the radio and tell them that, not in 1919. So he had to go in person. So everyone knows it's a terrible idea. You don't take a sick man and put him in a 100-degree train car and truck up around the country, shaking hundreds of hands and giving dozens of speeches. Total recipe for disaster. Edith, Joe Tumulty, Cary Grayson, they all say, this could literally kill you. He says, what a way to go in the service of my beloved League of Nations. So they can't talk him out of martyring himself. So they just all decide to go with him and sort of save him from his worst self. The train tour is just as bad as everyone predicted. It's even worse because he doesn't even get a break as he's moving from city to city because inevitably a local politician will board the train, you know, in Des Moines and say, I'll ride with you, you know, the rest of the way to Sioux Falls because I want to bend your ear about my local pet project. You know, so he's getting sicker and sicker. He's having headaches that render him literally blind at times. The train tour goes all the way out west to Spokane, Seattle, down the west coast, California, and is doubling back up the train somewhere outside of Pueblo, Colorado, when the president collapses. It's clear he can't go on. They cancel the rest of the train tour. The train comes rushing back to Washington. He was sort of okay enough at that point that when the train stopped at Union Station, he got off the train, kind of waved to the crowds, goes to the White House. A week later, collapses completely. So early October 1919, massive stroke. Not that you would know it from the dispatches being released to the public. They say things like nervous exhaustion, which is not a thing. His whole left side was paralyzed. His life really did hang in the balance. He got a secondary infection. It wasn't clear if he would pull through. even after he was out of mortal danger, he was a very sick man. He remained paralyzed on his left side. His speech was slurred. He found it very hard to concentrate and follow a conversation. He couldn't really sit up. They had tried to put him in a wheelchair and he sort of listed. So they rented one of those rolling beach chairs from Atlantic City, which was a little bit clownish, but did the job and kind of propped him up in that. He slept a lot and he really was not capable of doing the job he was elected to do. In addition, the treatment for stroke at the time was to be kept very quiet. You were told the patient must face no stress, not make any hard decisions, not hear any bad news, must be kept physically very still, must sleep a lot. Well, what does a president do all day? A president makes hard decisions and faces bad news and encounters stress. That's part of the job. So even if Wilson's mind were perfect, and it's very clear to me it was not, he was being told not to use it. He was being told that he had to be kept in this bubble. So Edith, along with Joe Tumulty and Carrie Grayson, decided right then that they would close ranks and they would not tell anybody how sick he was. In Edith's memoir, she describes it this way, that she was told if he does all the things he was elected to do, he's going to die. If he resigns, he's going to die because he's entirely living to see this dream of the League of Nations realized. And if you take that away, he's got nothing to live for. So if he stays president, he dies. If he quits, he dies. And if he dies, there will never be world peace. So that's the stakes. And in Edith's mind, the only path open to her, she says, was to do his job for him until he was better enough to do it himself. That's preposterous. We have a vice president, right? We have someone actually elected to step in when the president cannot serve. However, the 25th Amendment didn't exist. And so the mechanism by which the vice president takes over was murky. The vice president, how many of you know the name Thomas Marshall, former governor of Indiana? Two. Yeah. Lost to history, old Thomas Marshall. You can read his memoir. It's called A Hoosier Salad. And it's like 200 pages of quippy one-liners. He had sort of taken on this court jester role in the Wilson administration, and he wanted no part of being seen to usurp the presidency in any illegitimate way. So he was aced out of this whole inner circle. And not only did they lie to the public, they lied to the press, they lied to the Congress, they lied to the cabinet, they lied to the president himself. He never knew how sick he was. And to me, that is the most important legacy of this era. I don't think Edith went rogue and, you know, championed legislation he wouldn't have championed. She knew his mind quite well. But even if she was taking every decision to him, and it's obvious she was not, his judgment was terrible because he didn't face bad news because she wasn't telling him. So when the nation moved on entirely from World War I and was sick of the deprivation of World War I and wanted no part of what Woodrow Wilson was selling them and absolutely rallied around Warren Harding's return to normalcy message, Wilson didn't know that. He thought that the, you know, cheering crowds he had encountered on the train were still there because no one told him otherwise. And so when he dug in his heels even further about the League of Nations and refused to really pay attention to other political issues, the Red Scare that was going on, the xenophobia, his own attorney general going rogue, prohibition, labor unrest, there was a lot going on in 1920. He wasn't paying any attention to that because he was blinder focused on the League of Nations because no one was telling him any different. And so when Warren Harding was elected in an absolute landslide in 1920, the only American voter who was surprised was Woodrow Wilson. This went on, I have to say, this is one of the things that surprised me in my research. So he got sick in October of 1919. He was not seen in public until April of 1920. Think about that. Not seen in public, not just not giving a statement or not taking questions, not seen. And at one point, the press finally said, you know, if he's okay, let us see him. And if he's not okay, we kind of need to know that. And so they sort of propped him up in a car and drove him around town. That's what this is a picture of. So you look at Edith looking very concerned, Carrie Grayson keeping an eye on him. They had to find a cape-style coat because he couldn't thread his left arm through the sleeve of a coat. And he's kind of wedged into that corner of the car. And then throughout 1920, he got better-ish. He started to be able to sit up for longer, have some meetings, but it was all very, very controlled. And then Harding's elected in 1920. He's now the lamest of lame ducks. At the time, the inauguration was in March, so they've got this time to figure out what's next. They started publishing a few interviews with sympathetic reporters. That's what this picture is from. This is the picture I was referring to that's on the cover of a lot of books. This was part of a very flattering magazine profile. But she's holding that paper steady for him to be able to sign his name. By the time they started planning for their post-White House years, Edith finally started referring to him as an invalid. And she calls him an invalid in her memoir. She knows he's never going to get better. They didn't have a house. She had sold the 20th Street house, and he hadn't had a house since he lived in Princeton in 1910. But they decided to stay in Washington. They bought a house in Calorama on S Street. It is still a museum, absolutely worth a visit, the Woodrow Wilson House on S Street. And he died in 1924. She lived till 1961. So what did she do in those 37 years? Well, she went back to being a sort of fabulous wealthy widow about town, traveled a ton. She had always traveled a lot. And she curated his legacy. So this image of Woodrow Wilson, which is being revised a lot now, of this visionary of global peace, is to an astonishing degree Edith's creation. She showed up at everything. So this is just before she died. She died in December of 1961. And President Kennedy is handing her the pen with which he has just signed legislation creating a Wilson Memorial. The Wilson Memorial is not a statue. It's a living memorial. It's the Wilson Center, which is an international policy think tank. And you can see she's still got some pretty great hats and furs on. And the Sayre kids, his grandkids, are in the background there. Her memoir ends the day he dies. She wrote more chapters, but her publisher didn't think anyone would be interested in them. They existed in longhand at the house in Withville, where some wonderful volunteers transcribed them, and they let me see them, which is amazing. Unpublished first-person narratives that other scholars had not gotten to use. There's no smoking gun in them. They never, you know, she never admits to anything more than she did in the published version, but it is more of her voice and certainly more of this era of her life and what she did with her time. So that is her story. I'm eager to take your questions. I think just in general, I would say, as you guys are scurrying around with microphones, to me, her legacy is complicated, right? And made more complicated by the fact that she threw up so many smoke and mirrors to hide her own role. But fascinating and impressive at the same time. So I'm eager to take your questions. So these guys have microphones. If you just raise your hand, they'll come to you and let me know that you're there. Hi.
What I have read someplace, Galt Jewelry was bankrupt when Mr. Galt died. Is that true or not?
It wasn't bankrupt. It was in debt. So the official name of it was Galt and Brothers, and it had been run by several generations of Galts, but Norman bought out his father and brother,
And so when he died, that money was still owed. It was, however, a profitable business still. So when Edith inherited it, she had to kind of figure out how to manage that debt and how to keep the doors open if that's what she wanted to do. And she did consider selling it and just sending it off. But she took that Galt family legacy pretty seriously. It had been around for a long time. And so in her telling, you know, that straitened childhood came in handy. She knew how to live frugally, and she didn't take any salary for herself. And she sort of tightened her belt until Norman's debt was paid off, but it was not bankrupt. It was still a profitable business. There was just a debt owed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Way in the back. Yeah.
Hi. I was curious if the extra chapters of her memoir are available anywhere or if that's just under wraps.
Stephen say no, no, they, no, they are not available to the public. I think the Birthplace Museum in Wytheville hopes at some point to read. They have the royalty, the rights on the memoir, and they hope to republish it with those chapters at some point. Yeah.
Hi, that was just so interesting. But during that period when she was in charge, there was no legislation passed, right? Because the Republican Congress didn't want to do anything.
Well, there was plenty of legislation passed, including like the Volstead Act. I mean, there was important legislation passed. There were some laws that went into effect without a presidential signature. There's a deadline that after which they become law automatically. And certainly there were things that were ignored. But Congress was, while divided from the presidency, both houses were Republican, so they were passing legislature.
And he wanted the Volstead Act passed?
No, he probably, he vetoed it, or maybe she vetoed it. He always said that it was the wrong way to go about the right thing. The veto was overridden in a minute and a half, but he was sort of pro-temperance, but thought federal prohibition was probably the wrong idea. Who's got a microphone up there? Yeah.
I have a question about the relationship between Margaret Wilson and Edith. Mm-hmm. My understanding, I might not be correct about this, is that Margaret took on some first lady duties for that short time between the death of her mother and the marriage of her father and Edith. Do you know what their relationship was like? And also, I believe that Margaret was pro-suffrage and Edith was anti. Did they clash over those issues?
Yeah. So you're right, Margaret, to the degree there was any first ladying being done in that era, Margaret was acting. And if you look at a list of first ladies, you'll see Margaret Woodrow Wilson, 1914 to 1916. She hated it, and she would have preferred to be off on her concert tour. And she was pro-suffrage, as was Jessie, the second daughter. Nell, not so much. And they did harass their father to be more supportive of federal suffrage. He, his views evolved, let's put it that way. But by the time he finally supported the 19th Amendment in 1918, it was really largely for reasons of electoral math, which I don't blame him for, that's what a politician does. But he saw that states were enfranchising women, and he was worried that all those new voters would vote Republican. Margaret and, well, all of the daughters and Edith, in public, they were very supportive of each other. All the daughters said they were so happy to see their father happy. And even if he had moved on, you know, 5 months after their mother's death, they did not publicly say anything about that. In private, there are some letters that are searchable on the website of the Woodrow Wilson birthplace in Stanton, where they talk a little trash about her. They say that her family is so awful and that she doesn't take a hint and that, you know, they get a little frustrated with her. But in public, they were all nice about it. Both Margaret and Jessie died quite young. Nell, the third daughter, was the one who was still around. There were a lot of celebrations in 1956, the centennial of Wilson's birth. And so Nell and Edith were on a lot of stages together. By then, they had had a falling out because Nell's husband, William McAdoo, always thought he should be Wilson's heir apparent. And Wilson never endorsed him. And in fact, Wilson floated the idea of running for a third term in 1920. That's how isolated he had been kept from his own illness. I mean, he never would have survived a campaign. He never would have won if he had. So there was some bad blood there, and yeah, but in public, they were all very supportive of each other.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation. I was thinking of Lloyd Austin, and I know it's different eras, but here he was out of the public eye for 3 days, and this president was out of the public eye for a year. Could you go into more detail how they kept the dogs at bay?
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think obviously pre-24-hour news cycle, even pre like dedicated White House reporters, like there wasn't necessarily a constant drumbeat of news coming out of the White House at the time. And it was all just more tightly controlled because there weren't cameras on everybody's cell phones and, you know, all of that. There were more leaks than I thought there would be. I thought their lockdown was pretty complete. But if you read the newspaper coverage, and again, it was only newspapers, there are some articles in like February, March 1920, where they talk about Mrs. Wilson acting as the president. And surprisingly, they are not all critical. Some of those articles say, what a wonderful wife. Isn't she doing a great job? So I think between some friendly reporters, a slightly different expectation of what the administration was expected to do, and certainly the tenacity of the press corps. Right. If the Secretary of Defense is in the hospital for 3 days, suddenly everybody knows about it, versus the president being gone for months and months. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. That ringing phone is mine.
I have a question in regards. You said that she went to school in Abington. Is there any indication of what school she may have gone to, who the teachers might have been?
Yeah, it's a spa now. It's called, what's it called? Oh my gosh, I am so embarrassed. It's now a like high-end weekend spa that has an Edith Bowling tea room. It's a historic house. I haven't been, but the pictures online look awfully pretty. Who ran it back then? It was one of those, you know, female seminaries. No, it was called Abingdon Female Seminary that were sort of cemetery that sort of bridged that like late high school, junior college role, like St. Mary's in Raleigh where the Wilson girls went, you know, but it was, Edith describes it as having a particularly strong music program, which is why her family chose it for her. Also, her older brother lived in Abingdon and could kind of keep an eye on her. She hated it. She was vicious about the headmaster. She thought he was like a character out of Dickens. They seem to have forgiven her if they've named the tea room after her, though. Who's got a microphone up there? Yeah.
It was very fascinating. Can I take you back to Paris when Wilson has arrived there and becomes ill? So I've read some things suggesting that more recently that he had caught the Spanish flu. But there also seems to be some evidence that after he came back, he wasn't as sharp, he was tired, and that while he focused on everything on the League of Nations, the big decisions were being made then from that point on by the British and the French, and Wilson really wasn't that much involved. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So this is actually an area that I really struggled with how much detail to go into in my book, because there are some terrific books about the Paris peace process, and this is not that. But I thought that
people needed to understand what was going on, to understand Edith's role in it, and to understand his later recalcitrance on the League of Nations. So I did a huge amount of research that I didn't put in the book because that's not what this book was about. But I will say there is quite a lot of disagreement on how sick he was, what he was sick with, and what the lasting effects of it were. And you can find biographers stating a whole range of options for those things. Was it the flu or was it a stroke? If it was the flu, was it the Spanish flu? When he behaved erratically after that, and there's some evidence that he did, was that a lingering neurological effect of the fever, or was it the beginning of the end? Or was it just exhaustion and frustration with the process, which was grueling and endless? And there is a fair amount of sort of retroactive diagnosis going on, including about his stroke in 1919. And they try to find the roots of it in that incident and an incident even when he was younger, when he writes a letter where he talks about troubles with his vision. And was that an early sign of thrombosis? You know, so you can fall pretty deeply down that research hole. I think it's clear he got sick. He got quite sick. And the effects of it did make him short-tempered and maybe even irrational for a little while there in Paris. And then as he came home and was more exhausted, it was exacerbated. I will say that he was by nature quite tunnel vision and also very, very sure of his own righteousness. And so if he did have lingering effects from whatever that illness was, they didn't create new character traits. They might have exacerbated his own already bad tendencies. I'm looking for whoever has a microphone. Yeah.
I do. Hello. Thank you. I don't know so much about this period of history, so I'm trying to imagine how it would be to substitute as the president, and how would you organize it, especially if it was a secret? Did you have a log, or did people log in to see her like a regular public figure, or did she go around the hill and represent, who did she represent if not the president?
Yeah.
So how did she do that?
Yeah. So she, from the beginning, said that anybody who wanted to see him needed to see her. And at the beginning, that wasn't that many people because they were trying to respect his convalescence. But there were a few urgent things. At the time, the president needed to sign diplomatic papers personally, things like that. So she told everyone to come to her instead. As his illness wore on and people needed him more and more, and it became clear he wasn't showing up on the hill anytime soon, more and more people came to the White House. They came to her. She would then say, go away, or give me what you have. I'll go get an answer from the president and bring it back to you. And then go write the answer and bring it back to them. Or go see someone else instead. But she said, go away, to a huge number of people. And in fact, when people started also addressing all their correspondence to her, because it became very clear that if you wanted to get something done by the executive branch, you address things to her. When she donated papers to the Library of Congress at the end of her life, they found a whole stack of mail that was never opened. And inaction has consequences too, right? So her ignoring whatever was in those letters also left a legacy. But that was it. She instructed everyone to come to her. She didn't go out to them in any way. And in fact, one of the cracks in the conspiracy armor was that, you know, the cabinet wasn't meeting because the president wasn't calling them together. And the Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who had been threatening to quit long before Wilson got sick, started convening the cabinet on his own because he felt like they weren't getting anything done. And he was very frank about the fact that he hadn't seen the president and that no one in the cabinet had seen the president and the president wasn't making any decisions. So he was actually one of the leaks. And in fact, when the president found out that he
was that Lansing was holding cabinet meetings. He fired him. Who's got a
yes?
Find someone with a microphone
in the back. I visited this birthplace and museum for Woodrow Wilson and Stan years ago, and I seem to recall that they showed some clips from a Hollywood, what we would call a biopic, called Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't the whole film, just little scenes. I'm wondering, did Edith have anything to do with that
film?
She
sure did.
And how is she depicted in the film?
Yeah, so there was this MGM extravaganza in the 40s called Wilson. It was total jingoistic, patriotic, rallying people to World War II by remembering that great leader from the last World War. That was its goal. Edith was an advisor, as was Nell. And she made quite a bit of money from that. And she used that money to help start the Wilson Presidential Library at Stanton. So that is the connection there. If you haven't been there, go. So Wilson, he was born in, his father was a Presbyterian minister, and so he was born in the manse of that church there, but he only lived there till he was two. So it's not like they have a lot of furniture that meant something, you know, he didn't grow up there, but they have created a very nice and thoughtful museum around his legacy and life and times.
That's all we'll have time for in terms of questions and answers, but everyone is welcome to speak with Rebecca for a little bit longer in Commonwealth Hall. She'll be free to answer any more questions you might have and also to sign copies of her latest book. So let's all give her another round of applause for a wonderful lecture.